Whoa, an exciting new Jewish Bible app. We're going to talk about it today on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to our Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast. How many levels of interpretation are there of the scripture? How many levels of meaning are there in the Bible? Is this one and one only, or is the sky the limit? We'll talk about that today as we talk about interpreting the Jewish scriptures. And we'll take your calls, any Jewish-related question. So related to the Hebrew scriptures, related to the Hebrew language, related to messianic prophecy or Jewish background to the New Testament, related to Christians and the law, related to Israel today and the nations. We'll talk about that. Also, terrorism again in Israel in recent days. Want to talk about that. The resigning of Nikki Haley, who's done an unbelievable job, a shockingly bold and open job calling out the UN and the nations of the world for their anti-Semitism. So she deserves our appreciation. And then, the bottom of the hour, we're going to be joined by Dr. Jeff Seif, a new exciting Bible app being launched in Jerusalem today. So, a lot to talk about, and again, your calls, 866-34-TRUTH is the number to call. Right before we take your calls, and I share the most recent attack against me by a religious Jew online, let me just take a moment and ask you to give me your best ear. And I want to ask you a simple question. Is our ministry worth, to you, $1 a day or more? Simple question. Is it worth to you $1 a day or more? The daily radio show, the live stream on video, all the videos that we put out, all the articles that we put out, all the sermons and teachings and messages, all available to you for free. Is that worth to you $1 a day or more? I think most would say, oh, it's worth a whole lot more. I would hope so, because by God's grace, we're seeking to really minister to you in a quality way. Now, next question, can you spare $1 a day? Can you make that work in your budget? Some of you say, I could spare $10 a day, others $100 a day, others I can't even scrape together 3 cents a day. Everyone's in a different place. I'm asking you, everyone that can stand with us or even to step out in faith and stand with us, to become a torchbearer, one of our monthly supporters. The work we're doing is of great importance. By God's grace, it's His calling. He gets the credit and the glory for anything good. But we're on the front lines of reaching Jewish people with the good news of the Messiah. Just the other day, got a text of someone else, another Jewish man, coming to faith in Jesus while reading The Real Kosher Jesus. We've got some amazing opportunities to get some of our key messages out all over Israel, on TV and in written form and online. Incredible open doors. Some of it's happening already. We're on the front line, standing for righteousness in the society, helping equip. We're asked to do this around the country, around the world. Help us stand with grace and truth, dealing with the culture wars and so many other things as we're raising up laborers and sending them out to the nations. But we really need your help and support. We hardly ever ask for this on the radio, but I'm coming to you saying we have some real needs. If you can help us with a one-time gift, that would be terrific. We trust God is supplying, but perhaps He's going to supply through you. So my heartfelt appeal to stand with us today, to take a moment and go to our website, askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org. Click on donate. And when you become a monthly supporter, it gives you free access to online classes we've taught, audio and video. It gives you a 15% discount on our online bookstore. It gives you a discount if you come on an Israel trip with me. It enables you to get certain teachings that are not available to the general public. You get an insider prayer letter every month, and you also get a new audio message for everyone standing with us with $1 or more per day, $30 or more per month. Become a torchbearer. Join our support team. And I'm going to be wildly honest with you here, all right? There are ministries that TV ministries, major Christian ministries that have tens of thousands, many, many tens of thousands of monthly supporters. Some have several hundred thousand monthly supporters. And I'd say by God's grace, we are producing and putting out as much as any of them are in terms of life-changing material. Again, all by his grace. And thank God for every other good ministry on the planet. We need everyone that's preaching Jesus. But we do what we do with just a few hundred. It's in the hundreds, our monthly supporters. Yeah. So our little team does an amazing amount. I'm asking you to join our team today. Would you do that? Go to AskDrBrown.org. If you feel led to help us with a one-time gift, that would be awesome. But better still, become a monthly torchbearer with $30, $50, $100, $500 a month. And it would really take some pressure off of us and enable us to do what we're doing to touch even more people. And here's what we deal with on a daily basis. I just noticed this post from a gentleman named Moshe. It got removed because of the insults, and we try to not allow that online. Even if it's attacking me, we try not to allow it in principle. But he was watching a video where I was saying once again to Rabbi Tovia Singer, here's the true story on our debates, and here's the true story about me being willing to debate you again for over 25 years now and been refused on every level. So here's what he posts. You're like one of those fifth graders that will find any excuse possible to not do his chores. Assume whatever you want and do God's commandments. Shabbat, so Sabbath, kashrut, kosher, dietary laws, tefillin, so putting on phylacteries, etc. But you do not and will not because you are a goy and an animal by nature. Now, this is a more pleasant attack. We get far uglier things by the day. But here's what's so interesting about this, and I bring it up on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Number one, the idea that deny yourself, take up the cross, and follow me is the easy way, is the cop-out way. Having to forgive your enemies and give yourselves to extended times of prayer and fasting and go to places where you'll be rejected and hated. That's the easy way out. That's the first misnomer there. Go ahead and join me. Take up the cross. Crucify the flesh. Go ahead and join me. Secondly, so happens that Shabbat is Shabbat. I don't observe it in an Orthodox Jewish way. I don't agree with many of those traditions, but Shabbat's a gift. Shabbat's a blessing. And kosher dietary laws, actually, I don't eat anything that's not kosher under any, ever. Never violate biblical laws. And even with rabbinic, you know, milk and meat, you can't have that together. I don't have that. I don't have any dairy in my diet, aside from the fact. And tefillin, if I felt that's what God was saying in Scripture, I'd do it in a heartbeat. Do it in a heartbeat. So the idea that we take the easy way, that's first thing. Second thing, calling me a Gentile. Isn't that wild? So telling me I'm a Jew looking for a cop-out because I'm really a Gentile, fascinating. And then an animal by nature. So this exposes some extreme Jewish bigotry. This is not the idea of an average Jewish person or a secular Jew that you'll meet, but there are some very Orthodox Jews who do believe that a Gentile soul is not the same as a Jewish soul. Every Orthodox Jew would believe that the Jewish people have been given a special commission and a special calling and a special responsibility and a special burden. But only some would believe that there's a fundamental difference between a Gentile soul and a Jewish soul, and they rely on some of teaching of classic rabbis to argue this point, that a Gentile soul is an animal soul by nature. So this poor guy who comes to rebuke me really needs to know the Lord. He needs to know the love of God and God's mind-blowing love for every human being on the planet. But these are the kind of folks that we're dealing with, and by God's grace, we're going to reach them. I can't say everyone, but we're going to reach them with the gospel and with your help and support. So stand with us. Go right now. If you're watching this later on YouTube or listening on a podcast, do it. Take a minute to do it. We'd really be blessed by it. You'll be blessed because you'll be sharing in the reward. And from all my heart and on behalf of our team, thank you for your support, for standing with us today. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to the phones. Philip in Savannah, Georgia, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brown, how are you doing today?
Very well, thank you, sir.
My question is about your Jewish apologetics approach. And first of all, it's brilliant, so it's not an all criticism. It's simply an educational question for me. If you look at the way you approach bringing the gospel to Jewish unbelievers, it seems like you really take great caution and care to establish the harmony between the Christian faith and the Jewish faith, how thoroughly Jewish the belief in Jesus is, the New Testament, the original apostles, and what they were talking about. However, on the other hand, it seems like, you know, if you watch most apologetics, talking to, for example, an atheist unbeliever, you'll see them spend a lot of time talking about the historical evidence for the resurrection, the dating of the original documents of the New Testament and secular documentation of Jesus, et cetera, et cetera. Is there a particular reason why you don't emphasize that as much? And if so, would it be more so because of your approach or more so because believing Jews are not as receptive to that evidence and they disregard it for whatever reason?
Yeah, look at it like this. Let's say we're in a boxing match and you are famous for having a real devastating right hook, right? So I'm going to make sure my left hand is always up. My glove is always up because that's your big punch, right? The deal is that for decades and decades and decades, the main objections that came to me were not what's the historical evidence of the resurrection or what's the dating of the New Testament documents. The arguments were that you're making God into a man or a man into a God, that you're saying God is three. We don't need blood atonement. We don't need the blood of a man. We are saved through God's mercy and Torah observance, and we don't need your Jesus. In other words, the objections that I answer in five volumes of Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus and in dialogue since then hardly ever touch on these other issues. That's one. Two is that there are other great Christian scholars, apologists, historians who have provided great data on that, so I can just refer people to it. But it's really simple. There hasn't been a need. That hasn't been the nature of the objection, or in my analogy, the punch that I'm blocking or responding to. Now, that being said, I do hope to write a book about resurrection, coming at it from a very different angle, somewhere in the next year or two. I hope to do it and get it out, where I will touch on that evidence. And there are some anti-missionaries that have attacked those things, but it's not the main argument that we get. So we're responding to the arguments that we get and trying to show the Jewishness of Jesus and the Jewishness of our messianic beliefs. That's all. It's not a matter of neglecting one. It's a matter of responding to questions and issues and arguments, and those are the main ones that we get. Hey, thank you. Great question. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to The Line of Fire. This is Michael Brown. Delighted to be with you. 866-348-7884 on this thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Terrorist attack, fatal attack in the West Bank, Judea, Samaria on Sunday. Two young Israelis killed, the third wounded. And as Jerusalem Post notes, it took place at the Barkan industrial zone, a major source of employment for Palestinians. So Israelis enhancing the economy and often seen as an area of coexistence. And Fatah, so Palestinian leadership, they basically blame it on Israel. They say that as long as our people remain deprived of rights in their homeland, these things are going to happen. So it's Israel's fault. And last week on their homepage, Fatah published a post glorifying Mullah Halabi, the Palestinian who stabbed two people in the old city in Jerusalem in 2015, calling him the heroic martyr. This is so reprehensible and ugly. Terrible loss once again. And this is why Israel has to do what it does to defend itself. Oh, yeah, Israel's far from a perfect nation, and I'd love to see Israel do certain things differently. But this is a nation simply seeking to protect its own citizens from terror. That's the biggest issue. Things are the way they are. The biggest reason they are the way they are. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Las Vegas, Nevada. Deb, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, thank you, Dr. Brown. So I have a question about whether God considers me a Jew, because I married an Israeli Jew who's not terribly observant, but, you know, whose Judaism, like most Israelis, is very important to him, at least culturally, and he has some faith. So I was actually going through the conversion through a conservative synagogue when I found Christ. And that just completely put a spanner in the works, because, you know, as far as I know, no rabbi is going to, you know, convert me, and, you know, they won't have me. So my you know, my question is, does since in the past, since Esther, you know, and the other people who joined Israel didn't have to undergo, you know, a rabbinically authorized conversion, but just, you know, joined the tribe, you know, since my intention was to join the tribe, and I am actually part of my husband's family, an extended Israeli family, and my son, he wants our son to bar mitzvah in Jerusalem, even though that poses a problem since I'm not considered a Jew. But what I want to know really is, does God consider me a Jew, or could God consider me a Jew? And I don't know.
Yeah, well, yeah. What an interesting, amazing story. Can I ask you just a couple of questions?
Yes, of course.
Okay. First question is, how has this affected your relationship with your husband?
It's been pretty bad. He considered it a great betrayal. You know, he still considered it. He didn't accept it at all at first. I wasn't allowed to talk about my faith at all. He softened over time, and he sees that it's been good for me. Because it's funny, ironically, I was actually an atheist before. But he was fine for me to become a Jew as an atheist.
Yeah. No, of course. That's Jewish atheist. Jewish atheist, no problem. Jewish Buddhist, no problem. Jew for Jesus, big problem. Big problem. Okay. And then I'm glad, though, that things are where they are, because it could obviously be a lot worse, or the marriage wouldn't have even made it. So thank God it's gone this far, and there's always hope for the future. Second question is, why does it matter to you? And this is not a leading question. This is not meant in any negative way. But why does it matter to you how God sees you? In other words, if you're in Jesus, if you're a daughter of God, whether he sees you as Jew or Gentile, why does it matter to you?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it's not that I see that it would make me have a different, any kind of a different salvation. I mean, salvation is salvation. It's more, I want to know God's plan for me. I want to know if there are different obligations that, you know, I should be trying to fulfill as part of the Jewish nation. And I also feel, you know, some sadness about not having been allowed to join the nation. And it has caused, you know, a great deal of family conflict. And, you know, there's no doubt that, you know, it would create greater family kind of harmony if I would consider part of the tribe, although I know that it's always going to be problematic and there would always be those who would never accept me. I get that.
Right.
I want to know how God considers me and what I should be doing to please him, I suppose, at the end of the day.
Right. So here's the bottom line on this. Obviously, there are certain things where I can speak for God because I'm just telling you what the Bible says, right?
Yes.
In a case like this, you know, someone could argue that every born-again believer in Jesus is a spiritual Jew based on Romans 2. I don't read the text like that, but you're asking something deeper than that. And because of, you know, you raised the issue about Ruth joining the people, joining their faith.
Yeah.
Right, but
yeah.
There was obviously a complete joining of herself to the faith of Israel, whereas you've joined yourself to your husband, but you're not practicing Judaism. I mean, nor is he. So let me say...
Although we might. But just to interject, I mean, we actually might. So he's actually wanting to practice more,
right?
And, you know, there's just
and that could be right. That could be his. That could be his path to the Lord, or conversely, that could create greater conflict. But here's what I would just suggest to you. Okay, two things. Number one, you have joined yourself to the people of Israel, heart and soul. All right, that you know. I would say to the Lord, show me the mentality, show me how I should think of myself since I have joined myself to the people of Israel, heart, so heart, body, soul, right? You know, Lord, what does that mean? So everyone, every Gentile Christian is spiritually joined together with every Messianic Jew. We are one in the Messiah, but you are joined in a unique way because of your husband, because of Israel. So that's where I would start. You are someone who is joined body and soul to, and heart and mind, to the people of Israel, to the Jewish people. What does that mean? How should you see yourself or identify? And the Lord will have to show you. The second thing is that I do not believe there would be different requirements put on you by God, because I don't believe that a Jew under the new covenant, even if you were born Jewish, that you were required to observe the Sinai covenant or observe traditional Judaism, right, but rather follow God in light of the new and better covenant. So that to me would be more of a matter of cultural identification. In other words, you say, I just feel that married to an Israeli or living in Israel or whatever, you know, the case would be over the years, that there's a joining together and that therefore I'm identifying more with the people of Israel. And if someone says, well, why don't you just go through conversion? Well, because I'm a follower of Jesus, the Jew. And that's where you tell them to read my book, The Real Kosher Jesus, to help them understand that. Right. By the way, do you have that volume?
I don't. I should get it.
All right. Well, to tell you what, I want to send it to you. But do you think your husband would read it?
No.
No. Okay. All right. No. Well, anyway, you can have it out on the table. Stay right there, Deb. And Kim is going to come on in a second, our faithful call screener, and he's going to come on and get your info so we can send you a free copy of The Real Kosher Jesus. All right. God bless, and may the Lord move mightily and open your husband's eyes to the reality of our Messiah. Let us go to Gary in Holly Springs, North Carolina. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Almost okay. Loud and clear, but I can hear you.
Okay. Let me shut the speaker up.
Yeah, we need you talking, right?
How about now?
That's what we need. That's better.
Okay. Dr. Brent, I'm a Messianic Jew. I've told you once before. I'm part of a men's group on Friday mornings. And one of the questions that came up I did a talk on the Day of Atonement. And I know that in the Ark of the Covenant was there, and I know that when Solomon built the first temple, the Ark of the Covenant was there. Mm-hmm. And I know that the high priest was only allowed to go into the Holy of Holies, where the Ark of the Covenant was, on the Day of Atonement. Mm-hmm. And I know that's like entering the presence of God, a very holy place. The question is, when they came back from the captivity and they built the second temple, was the Ark of the Covenant in the Holy of Holies in that temple?
No, sir. No, that never came back from Babylon. There's endless speculation about what happened to it, and is it hidden somewhere, and, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark and all that. But no, it didn't come back. And the book of Jeremiah says the day will come when you won't even think about it anymore. But no, that was not there. So when the high priest went into the holiest place of all, some of the most essential items were missing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that was my question. Yeah, because I thought that reason that the high priest couldn't go into the Holy of Holies was because of the presence of the Ark of the Covenant, that it was for holy. But if it wasn't there in the second temple, it was just tradition that he only went into the Holy of Holies on
No, it was because that's the place where God said he would meet with them. So the Ark was the setting for it, but the holiness of it came because God would come there. So yes, the Ark was holy, but the place was Kodesh Kodeshim, was most holy because that's where God's presence would come and be manifest between the cherubim, all right? So it was the presence of God coming down there in the holiest place of all on the Ark or over the Ark of the Covenant that made it so sacred. That continued to be the case, but there's no question There had to be a sense of something missing all the years the Second Temple was destroyed, and then God came and showed us a better way. Hey, thank you, sir, for the question.
Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Oh, yes. Yes, it is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Michael Brown, your Thoroughly Jewish host. So glad to be with you today. 866-34-TRUTH, the number to call. I'm about to be joined by a dear friend, fellow Messianic Jewish believer, biblical teacher and scholar, and the general editor of the Tree of Life version of the Bible, of which I've had the joy of participating in the translation process and distribution process. Before I bring Dr. Jeffrey Seif on with me with some exciting news from Jerusalem, according to traditional Judaism, there are 70 different faces to the Torah, 70 different aspects of interpretation in each verse. And then other Jewish interpretation looks for different levels, the plain sense of the scripture, and then a derived sense that, you know, hinting at something, or a homiletical sense or a mystical sense. And on the one hand, you find lots of those different levels of interpretation within the New Testament, going back and seeing things in the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures, that we might not have seen, that we might have missed along the way, and further spiritual insights. But here's the bottom line. The plain sense of Scripture can never be overturned. There may be a deeper insight we get. There may be a spiritual application. The Lord speaks to us personally. You know, maybe you're out of work and you're moaning and complaining, and you read 1 Thessalonians 5, and someone doesn't work, you shouldn't eat. And so it's like a word for you directly. I mean, it's plain sense, but it's for you directly. But bottom line is that the better we can understand what's written, the better we can obey God. The better we can understand what's written, the better we can know God. And the Tree of Life version plays a very unique role in that it's the first version by a combined team of Messianic Jewish scholars and Christian scholars working together to convey in clear, powerful English, but with Jewish sensitivity, the message of Jesus, Yeshua, the Messiah. I'm joined now by my good friend, Dr. Jeffrey Seif. Jeff, welcome back to the Line of Fire.
Well, it's great to be with you.
All right, so what in the world is happening in Jerusalem today?
Oh, goodness, I haven't been there for a number of months. It's been about half a year. You want me to respond to what you just said about different approaches to interpretation?
Well, you can, but I want to talk about the app that was released in Jerusalem, but we can get to that.
Okay. No, you're the boss. I'm following your lead. Relative to the app, actually, we're a few months out from the launch.
Okay.
That was really brought to bear through the generous help at Gateway, a big church in the Dallas area, very avant-garde. And they kind of got behind Danya Greenberg, the president of the society. And you have all this creative energy to come up with something of a one-of-a-kind app that's coming in short order.
Okay. So it's come, you know, I was looking at my notes and thought, already, boy, I didn't even realize. So we'll be talking more about that. So it's a couple months out. I got a sample on my phone today, which was, I was amazed. It's just a little picture of a little part of it. But have you been involved in the production of this?
Well, distantly, frankly, I don't want to overstate my involvement. Danya's working more with the technical team in that. And I'm a little out of the loop, a little distant. You know, I'm more of an eccentric Bible teacher type rather than a techie that's good with, I'm not even very good at using apps, never mind making them. But certainly on a consultant basis, I've been involved in the conversation.
Got it. Why are you personally so excited about the Tree of Life version?
Well, for the same reason that you said, Mike, that it's a joint venture effort. And at 63 years of age, you know, I'm less inclined to want to make my mark and my name, and I'm more predisposed to work in collaborative endeavors. And to see 70 or so individuals get together and participate in a process and a translation, to me, that just resonates with me. It guarantees a better work product than if it's just a one- or a two-person project.
And in your mind, because there's so many different translations out that are terrific, and there's David Stern's classic Jewish New Testament, yeah, now Complete Jewish Bible, which will always play a very important role. What are some of the things in terms of the actual translation and feel of the Tree of Life that you like best, either for teaching or for study or for having someone else read it? What are some of the features that you most enjoy?
Fair enough. Well, to your first point first, I'm glad that anybody reads any Bible in any translation. Sometimes you can overstate your case and weaken it as a result. I mean, the word is the word, the Bible is the Bible, and I'm glad people are game to do it. For me, a life vision has been wanting to help Jewish people come to know Jesus and wanting to help Jesus people come to know Jews. Mm. And I think this is a good extension of that. That is to say, a Jewish person can read it and more have a sense that they're reading their own story, whether from the Older or the Newer Testament. Similarly, a person who's non-tutored in Jewish things but is interested can get a bridge, a doorway into a new Jewish world.
And when it comes to the question of Jewish interpretation that I mentioned right at the beginning, obviously, if God says don't commit adultery, he does not mean commit adultery. He does not mean don't commit adultery more than 10 times. You know, it's pretty clear, pretty straightforward. Do we have a right to find deeper meanings, the acronym that's used by the rabbis, pardes, speaking of the different levels of meaning and interpretation that they'd find in the text? Do we have a right to do that? Are there dangers in doing that? How would you teach that since you've taught at Bible schools for decades?
Well, and I still do. In fact, in hermeneutics, I'm teaching that next semester. I'm interested. I am myself more predisposed to a plain sense of literature, to look at what words mean and what they say rather than be too creative. Sometimes when it comes to these creative applications that are teased out of the literature, I don't know whether that's just the creative energies of the interpreter that's talking or the text itself. It seems to me sometimes it leaps from the page and is more an extension of the creative energies of someone who's offering a telling of it. I don't like that personally. I am a little more careful and deliberate, not just as a theologian, but I have a career in law enforcement as well, in police and as a detective. I look at interpretation like a detective looks at a crime scene. You walk in there slowly, you look deeply, you pay attention to details, and you try and construct some tentative hypothesis about what happened there based on the facts that are actually there. And I'm concerned that this rush to find spiritual, you know, applications can do more harm than good at day's end.
Got it. So what if someone says, well, that's exactly what the New Testament authors do. They find all kinds of meanings that weren't there and come up with new insights you wouldn't have had. How do you respond to that?
Well, someone can make that claim, and it's worth looking at it on a case-by-case basis. I can understand how a reasonable and prudent Jewish person would do that, or even how a Christian theologian could do that. Having said that, it's not to say that there aren't applications to the literature that are not readily discernible, but I'm just throwing up a caution. I'm throwing up a yellow light to going through the intersection of interpreting with a lot of creativity more than just a flat red light.
Got it. And then the other thing would be that you are dealing with inspired interpretation is one thing. And the second thing, sometimes just a homiletical point is being made. In other words, like Paul speaking about don't muzzle the ox that treads out the corn, and God only care about oxen. Wasn't he saying this for us also? Well, in the first case, it was just a law about treating your animals in a fair way. But now he's making either a practical application. In this case, sometimes there's a homiletical application. But what concerns you is, and you've been in, as I have, Pentecostal charismatic circles over the years, that we can kind of dream up all kinds of ideas and read them back into the Bible, which is really dangerous.
Right. that's my principal point, and I'm open to variance and personal application. But I think that a first interpretation of a text belongs to the original hearers. It takes a kind of careful determination of what the world is back then and what the word is back then. Do that work first and make observations and then some tentative interpretations and then, by all means, an application. But just going back into an older Testament text and saying, here's what I feel and what the Lord has shown me about such and such, to me, I can't get comfortable in that saddle.
Got it. All clear. Hey, let's have a little fun and take some calls, all right?
Sure.
All right. We'll start in Norman, Oklahoma. Tom, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown.
Hello.
Hi, do you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I had a question about the Torah. Would you agree that the laws in the Torah, the punishments of the law, were didactic? Like they were a schoolmaster, like a teacher for, you know, like Hebrew students and stuff?
In other words, were they to be enforced, or by enforcing them, like, would Israel learn?
Would atonement supersede the punishments of the law? So wouldn't that mean, like, it just represents, like, the moral character of God?
All right, just so I can understand the question so we can answer it, are you questioning whether the death penalty was enforced in ancient Israel or whether it should be enforced after the cross?
Before Christ. Were they to be enforced in the Old Testament?
Got it. Okay, all clear. Yeah, Jeff, you go first. Were the death penalty laws given to be seriously enforced under the Sinai Covenant?
I'm inclined to think so, yes. Religion in the Older Testament isn't religion the way we think of it today. It's, in effect, a social contract that there's criminal law there, there's civil law. And so it certainly is a guide it's a construct for social life, not just for private religious life.
Right. Yeah, and to add, so again, this is not just a matter of someone commits adultery in your church and now you kill them. No, if they won't repent, you excommunicate them. But under Sinai Covenant, under Torah, oh, absolutely. We have examples of it. People were put to death. They were stoned. They were put to death in different ways. And God said repeatedly, this is so others may fear, they may see and fear, and even saying repeatedly, show no mercy. So do these things apply today? Have things changed since the cross? Is our relationship to God as a body different than ancient Israel's was? Yeah, for the very reasons Jeff just mentioned. That being said, those were all meant to teach. They were all meant to instruct by example. But were they carried out? Oh, yeah. Hebrew scriptures explicitly give examples of them being carried out. All right, we'll be right back with your questions and Dr. Jeff Seif.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Yeah, the voice of Paul Wilbur, mutual friend of Dr. Seif, and yours truly, Michael Brown. This is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. You are listening to or perhaps watching The Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH, the number to call. All right, we've got a Hebrew question. Maybe I'll get to that in a moment. First, let's get back to our guest, Dr. Jeffrey Seif. So, Jeff, if you could give one key lesson, if someone's a brand new believer, and you give them a Tree of Life Bible to read, and or whatever Bible translation they have, and you are going to give them one piece of advice. You're only going to get to talk to them one time about reading the Bible. What would you tell them? What would it be? Read it regularly, or how to read it, or to expect God to speak? If you don't tell, or one or two things, what would you tell that person? You're only going to get one shot to tell them, and this is going to become their life habit.
Well, it might depend on who I'm talking to. If I'm speaking to someone who's middle-aged and in a crisis, I might tell them one thing. If it's someone that's 16 years old that's looking at life afresh, I might tell them something else. But I suppose if it's just a message to everyone and anyone, irrespective of age, station in life and circumstance, I'd encourage them to read it with an open mind, to realize they're going back into an ancient world, and to try and hear the story in its own terms and be open to how their heart might flutter as a result of their so doing.
Got it. All right. I appreciate the wisdom in that. By the way, folks, we've got a beautiful large print edition of the Tree of Life. They're all beautifully produced Bibles, but you can get them at our website. We probably have several different editions over at askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org. Let's go over to Flagstaff, Arizona. Daniel, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Yeah, Dr. Brown, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, so I had a question about this, salvation by faith and its how it relates to Calvinism. See, in John 12, it says many people believed, but they did not want to confess him openly. So being that it says, you know, with the heart you believe unto justification, but with the mouth you confess to salvation, are they justified, but then they weren't saved? And then secondly, like about Calvinism, you know, how did they achieve faith if they were not elected to salvation?
All right. Now, by the way, normally on Thursdays, we reserve them for Jewish questions only, but this is a fine question to ask just on the wrong day, but we'll take it. Jeff, how would you respond to that question about Calvinism?
Well, first of all, I begin with an appreciation of Calvinism by trying to understand Calvin in context. Calvin entered the stage of the human drama when the world was in the clutches of a religious system that argued that you have to adhere to all the various nuances of the Roman Church. They're the gatekeepers of paradise. You have to please the priest and the pope, and there's this preoccupation with guilt and rules. And along comes someone who says, wait a minute. You don't have to do that. Your salvation was determined by God, and the burden is off of you. I see Calvin as very liberating in that context. But in the modern world today, which is a different world, I think there are perhaps better ways to look at the literature than be tethered by a framework that served its purpose in its day.
Got it. All right. I appreciate that angle on it. And Daniel, just in short, a Calvinist would say that you cannot truly believe, cannot truly have faith unless you are regenerated. So they would say God regenerates you, because of which you now believe and are now born again and love God. So I said regeneration, born again. Sorry, just didn't have it in the proper order there. But they would basically say you're regenerated first. Otherwise, you have no faith and you're spiritually dead and incapable of responding, even accepting God's gracious offer. So anyone who exercises true faith is a true believer and will never fall away permanently. So they will continue in faith until the end. If they go halfway and then renounce the Lord and die in their sin, then they were never truly saved, and it was only counterfeit faith. That would be their approach as Calvinists. Hey, thank you for the call. Hey, Jeff, we've never talked about this. I get asked this question constantly, and we have a video on it. So there's a question from Germany from Nikita. But I'm just going to address it here because we've addressed it many times on the air. Nikita, we have a video about the Nephilim. Who are the Nephilim? From Genesis chapter 6, because we get asked the question over and over again. So you can watch that video and see my response. But Jeff, what's your belief about the ones referenced as the Nephilim and then the sons of God in Genesis 6? Who are they?
Well, when I get asked those kind of questions, I approach it humbly. What I'll do simply as say, well, these are the different views on it. Do I have a preference for it? Not necessarily. I just serve up. These are the perspectives. Some think that these sons of God, or, you know, are actually fallen angels and spirits of some sort. And this is a perspective from the Jewish camp and this camp and that. That's all I do with all that stuff. It's beyond my pay grade. I'm not altogether certain. I don't have any baseline convictions.
That
might be a letdown.
No, that's hey, listen, there are plenty of subjects. That's how I have to answer as well. Here are the different views, and I'm not sure either way. So again, here's what folks do. So Nikita, just do this. Go to AskDrBrown.org, AskDrBrown.org. Click on Digital Library, all right? And you'll see, just search for Nephilim. Nephilim. You know how to spell it, just as it is in the Bible. Who are the Nephilim? What does Genesis 6:4 describe? And is it possible that there are Nephilim on the earth today? So you'll find my thoughts on that, Nikita. So I appreciate you calling with that. Again, we're not answering it more fully on the air because we've addressed it many, many times. Hey, Jeff, let me ask you this. Is it wrong for Christians today to want to observe a seventh-day Sabbath or celebrate the Feast of Israel? I'm talking about Gentile Christians in particular. Is this going back under the law? Is this going back from the reality, back to the shadow? How would you respond to that?
Well, you're kind of throwing me an easy ball to hit, and I appreciate that. It's a little easier than trying to give voice to the Nephilim back there in early Genesis. In the Messianic Jewish world, there's no mandate. That is to say, in the conventional Messianic Jewish world, we do not believe there is any requirement that individuals live within the promulgations of the Mosaic economy. That said, while it's not mandatory, it still is quite possible. That is to say, individuals who feel called to a Jewish lifestyle still will live within that particular matrix. Similarly, individuals of non-Jewish extract who feel called to identify with the Jewish people and raise up a Jewish believing in Jesus testimony, similarly live within that world. So do I think there's anything wrong with it? Absolutely not. I do think there's something wrong with those who advocate that individuals must adhere to the Mosaic economy. That's overstating the case.
Got it. Yeah, I'm absolutely with you on that. All right, let's try and grab one more call from India. Freya in India. What part of India are you in? Hello? Hello, are you there?
How are you?
Good. I can barely hear you. You know, I'm so sorry. Kim, please let our caller know. I really wanted to take a call from India, but we just can't hear her. But please do let her know that we wanted to take her call. Yeah, I'm just looking at the Hebrew comment that was posted. It's not a question. It's just some comments. So can't respond to that right here. Hey, Jeff, a couple minutes left. What do you think is the biggest thing that happens to a Christian when they discover the Jewishness of Jesus? What's the significance in their lives?
I think people want to feel that they're getting back to an authentic approach to what it means to be Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that for individuals that I've conversated with that live within a world, as you said, where there's an interest in Jewish feasts and celebrations and perspective, in their mind, I think they're closer to a truer sense of what it means to be authentically Christian, as opposed to an approach to what it means to be Christian that's refracted through maybe a Calvinistic worldview or a Catholic worldview or some other kind. There's a feeling that we're getting closer to the source. I think it's the same kind of feeling, by the way, that someone has that's in touch with Pentecostal experience. That is to say, we're getting back to those initial primal impulses.
Got it. And obviously, there's not a drop of truth or theology or glorious revelation that is sacrificed by recognizing the Jewish roots of our faith. Rather, there's a great connection and even a divine reality, as you said, an authenticity. And a lot of that you really find as you read through the Tree of Life version of the Bible. So, Jeff, I am really excited to see what happens with this app. And between Gateway's generosity and their tech experience and Danya's creativity, it could be amazing. We're out of time, man, but thanks for joining us today. God bless.
God bless.